It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, author Janet Mock shares her experience with coming out publicly as transgendered.
First, January's employment report comes out this Friday, and analysts say it's likely that unemployment will continue to fall.
We often hear of unemployment falling because people get jobs or because people stop looking for jobs altogether. Our next guest suggests that this month there might be something more at play.
Federal jobless benefits expired in December, and that may be encouraging for people to take. That might be encouraging people to take jobs they may have otherwise turned down.
Victoria McGrain joins us now. She's a reporter covering the Fed and the economy at the Wall Street Journal. Victoria, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be here.
Well, first of all, did I have that right? Is it likely that the unemployment number is going to continue to fall for this month?
It's never entirely sure if it will. I think that's what economists are predicting. In terms of the impact of the expiration of the jobless benefits program, that could show up in this month's data, or it might take a while to show up, especially if people are holding out hope that Congress will extend the program. The Senate is looking to pass a bill. They're bringing it up this week. It's just very unclear if it will actually ever become law.
So a fall in the jobless rate could be because of the expiration of those jobless benefits. That's one way it could play out. How would that play out?
So research suggests there's sort of two channels through which unemployment benefits affect the unemployment rate. And based on that research, one way could be that people who lose their benefits take a job, possibly because, without those benefits, they need to take a job, any job that pays to put food on their table. So suddenly they're more willing to take a job that pays less than maybe they were making before. And so that's one way that the rate could fall. People get jobs. The other way is that people may stop looking. And when you aren't looking for a job, you technically don't count as unemployed in that measure that most people focus on. And, the thinking is that people, to qualify for jobless benefits, you have to be applying for jobs. And there may be some people who just really think their chances are bad, but they're willing to keep applying as long as they're getting the benefits. When they stop getting the benefits, they give up.
So going back to that first point, that's been part of the political debate, the idea that if you keep extending unemployment benefits, it's a disincentive for people to take a job and maybe settle. But on the other hand, I think one of your sources actually in the piece said, yeah, but do we want lots of, engineers giving up looking for engineering work and taking jobs in maintenance or janitorial work or something like that?
Right. I mean, that is not necessarily a good thing for the economy if you have very skilled workers taking jobs that don't use those skills because they just need a paycheck. On the other hand, if someone has been unemployed for a long time, it may be because there isn't the demand for their skills anymore. Say a manufacturing worker, they're just not going to find that job. And while that's, a very sad story for that individual, it's not bad for the economy if that person has to take a less well-paying job. So, these are very difficult things to untangle. And there is, which just fuels the political debate.
Yeah, those unemployment numbers are really political football. They have been here in Wisconsin at the state level, certainly at the federal level. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's more complicated than saying the number is down 0.3% or up 0.3%, and that's good or bad news, isn't it?
Definitely. I mean, I cover the Federal Reserve, and this is something that Fed officials are struggling with a lot, trying to make sense of just how much they can rely on that unemployment rate to tell them how healthy the labor market is, and that has implications for the decisions that they make about the stimulus that they're providing to the economy and when they decide to start raising interest rates. And, the minutes from Fed meetings show that they don't know the answer to it. I mean, they're struggling with how to read the labor market right now.
Right, because we've been hearing for months now, they've got this program of bond buying and pumping some money into the economy. There's this constant question, when are they going to start tapering, is the word everybody uses. And if they're trying to use this sort of muddy number of unemployment, how do they make that kind of decision?
Well, the Fed, they have started tapering. They feel like they've seen enough progress in the labor market to feel that they can start pulling back on that. But it is true, both, with that program and then also, interest rates, when do they start raising those? If the unemployment rate, which was 6.7% in December, is an accurate reflection, then, they don't want to let it fall too fast before they start raising interest rates, because that could lead to inflation or financial bubbles. But if it's not really reflecting how much slack there is in the economy and they start to raise rates too soon, then, they're extinguishing a recovery before it gets off the ground.
You looked at North Carolina as an example of how this might work. What's going on there?
So North Carolina made changes to their state program that violated federal rules. And so in July, the state's residents lost access to the extended federal program. So it's seen by economists as kind of a test case of what might happen. And what has happened is the unemployment rate has dropped very steeply, far more steeply than the national rate since July. And it's hard to tease out exactly why that is. There's some evidence that people are finding jobs. Employment has gone up. But on the other hand, labor force participation, the share of adults who are actively looking for work or are working, has dropped as well. And that has dropped, faster than the national trend since those benefits expired.
So another thing just occurred to me, it could be that if it sounds like there's good economic news, confidence is increasing, maybe some people who are pessimistic, who bailed out of the job market, gave up, might hear, hey, there are jobs out there, get back into the job market. So in that case, if I'm doing the math in my head right, good economic news could increase the unemployment rate as those people start looking for jobs again.
Right. And where you would see that would be in the labor force participation rate. You
okay.
would see that start to go back up. But so far, it's only been going down as the overall trend. And that's sort of the question, the Fed and others are trying to answer as well. Like, these people who are dropping out, there's some evidence a good portion of them are retiring, and so they're never going to come back. But other people might be going to school or are temporarily, as you say, just discouraged. But if things start looking back up, they'll start searching again. And that, sort of changes this idea of how much slack or not slack is in the economy.
Getting back to the politics on all this, what is the latest state of play in Congress on the idea of extending those unemployment benefits? I know it hasn't happened the last couple tries.
Right. So Senate Democrats are looking to bring up a bill as early as this week. They have made a major concession and have agreed to offset the cost of extending the program for 3 months, which is what Republicans were looking for. So, I'm not quite sure if they're going to get enough Republican support to get over that, 60 votes threshold that you need in the Senate. Even if they do, it's unclear what would happen in the House. A number of House Republicans are deeply skeptical of the program, whether it's paid for or not, this idea that it's disincentivizing workers from looking for work. And, whether this far after the recession do we need to be providing this these emergency benefits to workers.
To wrap up, Victoria, with this kind of complicated state of affairs and assessing the unemployment rate, what are the kind of numbers, the kind of statistics that would have members of the Federal Reserve Board out in the streets dancing to the tunes of Happy Days Are Here Again?
I think if they saw, the unemployment rate going down being accompanied by, a leveling off or even an increase in the labor force participation rate. They're looking at things called, quits, which is, people actually voluntarily quitting their jobs. That's a sign of confidence because they are, leaving their job to go get a better job. Those are the sorts of things that would start making them feel better.
All right, Victoria, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was great to be here.
That's Victoria McGrane. She's a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She covers the Fed and the economy. Right now, we are trying to reach our next guest. In the meantime, we'll invite you to call in on the topic of Wisconsin politics. Just another month or so left in the legislative session. Governor waiting for bills on things like education. Plans have been shot down there so far. wondering what you would like to see out of Wisconsin state government in the remainder of the legislative session. They've got their eyes, of course, looking over their shoulders constantly at this fall's election season as well. Wonder how you think that might affect it.
We heard retiring Senator Dale Schultz on the Joy Cardine show this morning, and he mentioned that in his remaining time in the Senate, he wants to push hard for redistricting legislation and change the way in which our districts are drawn. So, you know, what do you think about that? You can call in with your reactions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
You can also tweet us. You can always tweet us, Central Time WPR. That's Central Time WPR, and share your thoughts or at any time offer your suggestions for programs or your responses to anything going on the show. That's Central Time WPR.
Of course, it's an election year as well, and a lot to look forward to in that regard. Probably not looking forward to all those political ads and the things that we're going to be subjected to between now and the fall, but nevertheless, it comes with the gig. So what races are you keeping an eye on? What are you hoping for in the outcomes in the gubernatorial races, the attorney general race, and even some of these assembly and Senate races here on the state level?
Hey, I'm going to level with you. We're shy at one guest, and we're looking for your help to give us some content on the show. Give us a call about Wisconsin politics, your top priorities. Sky's the limit. If you're governor for the day, what would you change? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. While you leap to your phone and call in again at 800-642-1234. Here's what's coming up on the rest of today's show. As we mentioned, we're going to be talking about Wisconsin Life's transition to the TV realm. Excited to see that coming. We're going to have a look at Super Bowl ads. We'll talk about the hits, the flops, what was good, what was bad. That's coming up later. And after 6 today, we've got a special for Black History Month, looking at digging deeper into the untold stories of the civil rights movement in the nation, how it affected the South, how it affected the way we think of race in the United States. That's coming up after 6, a special that I think is going to be worth tuning in for as part of our Black History Month coverage.
Talking about Wisconsin politics with you at 1-800-642-1234, among some of the topics we can talk about here. Mary Burke backs a minimum wage increase of $10.10. What do you think about that idea? She thinks it would help the state economy here. Scott Walker is getting campaign donations from out of the state. And also we heard that former Governor Jim Doyle has also made his $5,000 contribution to the Mary Burke campaign. So lots of money already being spent on a race that hasn't quite begun in full form yet.
We'll take a call now from Ken in Wausau. Ken, hi. Thanks for calling in.
Good afternoon. I'd like to see Wisconsin's government move back to a more progressive approach. Wisconsin was always known for being very progressive. I'd like to see us be more progressive in terms of education, conservation. I'd like us to parrot a little bit of what Minnesota's doing in terms of economic development. Those are the kinds of things I'd like to see.
All right, Ken. Thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your thoughts. Thanks to the rest of you who are on the line now. We do have our guest as scheduled now. While Americans have become more accepting of gays and lesbians in recent years, according to a lot of polls and some changes in state laws, some members of the LGBT community are still often overlooked and struggling with violence and discrimination. The transgendered community.
Hundreds of trans people are killed around the world yearly, and here in the United States, they're twice as likely as anyone to be unemployed. Our next guest is the author of A New Account of Life as a Young Trans Woman. Janet Mock is her name, and she first came out publicly as being trans in a Marie Claire article in 2011. Her new book is called Redefining Realness, My Path to Womanhood, Identity, Love, and So Much More. Janet, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, this is the first widely published account of life as a young trans woman that we know about. How does it feel to be a first?
It's so interesting. I don't really feel like I'm a first because I feel like I've heard these stories so much in so many different groups. I feel like maybe it's the first published account. So that feels great, but I've heard these stories for so long that I just feel as if I'm adding to a entire canon of people's stories and story sharing and storytelling, and I just hope that it redefining realness empowers others to step forward and tell their stories.
Why did you feel it was important to do that?
I think I continue to say that the only reason why I write is because I feel like I should be writing this story I didn't have growing up. And I also just, I guess, blankly feel for a lot of marginalized people that not enough of our stories are being told. And so by, you know, writing this story, I think that it offers reflection to people who grow up different, who are told that their lives are not valuable and worthy and legitimate. And I think that by having a book that is widely published, it kind of puts like a valuable stamp, at least in the media culture, that our lives do matter and our stories are worth hearing.
Mm-hmm. Who did you look toward for inspiration?
I think I looked to a lot of other writers, the writers that I sought refuge and reflection in as a young person sitting in the library in Honolulu, Hawaii, where I grew up. I think about writers like Alice Walker and Zora Neale Hurston and Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou. I think that they gave me reflection as a young person and enabled me to dream of a life of possibility for myself as a young woman. Yeah, that's kind of who I looked to.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about in your book about the Marie Claire article that came out in 2011 that kind of gave a synopsis, I suppose, of your life so far and coming out as a trans woman. But it didn't sound like you as you read it back to yourself. What was amiss about that story?
I just think it's really hard for a media portrait to discuss complexity and nuance in a space that only offers maybe 2,300 words, whereas I think in a book you have so much more space, you know, 80 to 90,000 words to discuss a lot more layers. And I think that the piece was, I think it did what it needed to do at the time, which was for me to step forward as a trans woman, as someone who had transitioned as a very young person, as an adolescent. It did that part. It did that part well, but I think that a lot of it wasn't able to be communicated in that piece because you only can do so much with the space allotted.
So, do you feel like you could sufficiently do that in the course of a book as opposed to, you know, a two-page article in a magazine, for example?
Oh, yeah, I definitely think so, just having that much space and also someone's attention for much longer. I think there's just more engagement in a book compared to a magazine article. And I think also its audience, and it's also the lack of filter. Like in that piece, there was an editor there, and there was also a writer who was writing about me in my voice, whereas this book is unfiltered. Mm-hmm. It's me and maybe some collaboration with my editor who gives me notes. But mostly it's very purely me, unfiltered, not anyone else's gatekeeping or anything. It's fully me. And so you get a more honest account.
Yeah. Did you still have any fears or reservations when you're setting out to write that book?
No, I don't think I had many many fears. I think that I dealt with a lot of the fears in the space of writing me at my computer or me at my notebook. That was where I allowed myself to just be a little scared. I never calculated audience when it came to writing my book. It was very much about things that I hadn't heard before being said in other books that I had read from this genre, specifically talking about the genre of trans memoir. And for me, it was just, how can I be as honest as possible? How can I hopefully give people something new, because it's for me, I guess, and just layered experiences and all of that. So I wasn't too scared of honesty or rawness or, I guess, vivid prose. But yeah, I think that I try to tackle that in the first draft of the book and then try to continue forward there, just staying honest.
Well, we'll continue talking after the news with Janet Mock, and we'll also talk about some of the challenges that that many trans people face, and we'll also take your calls as well. Janet Mock is the author of Redefining Realness, her story of life as a young trans woman.
And we'd like to hear from you. Are you, or is anyone you know, transgendered? What has the experience been like? Are there role models that young trans people can look to, or do you have advice to share? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're speaking with Janet Mock about her experience being a young trans woman. Her book is called Redefining Realness.
And we'd like to hear from you. Are you or is someone you know transgendered? What is the experience like for you or the person you know? Give a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
Let's go right to the phones and talk to Betty in Delavan. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
What's your comment?
I came from a family of 12, and my brother, who is now my sister, is a twin. And he said it's hard for me because he has been my brother's I'm 54, so a long time. But she takes a lot of flack for the life that she's living. He's on Facebook as Corinne Jutz, and he's got Bill after it. But that's the hardest part for me. I still think of him as my brother. That's very strange for me. But Corinne took a lot of crap going from the job that she had, and now she's a writer and writes poetry. But she still takes a lot of flack.
Betty, thanks for sharing that story. And Janet, my question for you is, what's your response to that? And did your sibling have the same challenges as we hear from Betty?
My siblings did not have the same challenge. I think that transition and finding yourself and all of that stuff, it does become a family issue when all are involved. But I think that when true love and understanding and affirmation is also involved in that, you decide to go on that journey and you try your best to use the correct pronouns, you know, the correct name for this person that you love that's in your family. And I think that that's what's always important. I know that I have two younger brothers and two older sisters from a big family of five kids, and everyone moved at a rapid rate. And they didn't make it so much about them and what they're used to in terms of their interactions with me. They made it very much about me and choosing to stand by me as I made this very difficult journey. And I think that has helped me a lot by having that family unit that decided to stand behind me and beside me and support me.
Thanks again for your call, Betty. Let's talk to Andrea in Milwaukee. Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
What's your question or comment?
Actually, I'm transgendered. I am actually a registered nurse. I have known since I was 3 years old. I have great family support, great friends. Actually, I'm in my early 40s right now, so it's been a lot easier as I've gotten older. I got the actual final surgery when I was 23. Mm-hmm. And people thought that I might have been too young to make that decision, but I never had any regrets, and I don't look back.
Thanks, Andrea. What do you say to that, Janet?
I think it's powerful. I think any time that we can step into who we are and declare our truth and live our life very openly, that, and also be embraced by those that we love, that that's a powerful and empowering experience to hear about. So I'm just so happy that she can live this life and be herself mm-hmm. safely and in love.
She mentioned that there were some concerns that she was too young at 23, that maybe that was too early. What's your response to that?
I don't think it's ever too early to be yourself. That would be my simplest response.
I wanted to talk to you about bullying in schools, because I imagine that this is a pretty big issue that transgendered students have to face. And did you have to deal with that, and how did you deal with it?
Yes, I do detail in my book, Redefining Realness, about my youth experiences, specifically being in school, a space that's often very much gendered, right? It's separated by gender, boys here, girls there, and my struggles with that when we're talking about restroom use, when we're talking about sports, and all these different spaces that trans youth and trans students have to navigate and also have to fight for rights in school. So I think schools should be a space that are welcoming and affirming of young people, regardless of their gender identity or sexual orientation. And I think for me, you know, there was name calling and there were all those kind of things going on. But I think that I had really great teachers who did role model very supported behavior in the class and would not accept intolerance. And I think that that really enabled me to thrive through school. I was president, vice president of my class. I played tuba in the marching band. I was captain of the volleyball team. I was very much involved. And I also left school, graduated with the only scholarship to college that our school had at the time. And that was all because I had a very supportive school environment that made me feel welcomed and affirmed, and as if this is also my school, so I deserve space there.
Could you give some specific examples of how teachers have, in your experience, fostered that safe environment, or how they could today?
I think the easiest way is to not accept any intolerance. The number one thing would, if there's name calling in class and you notice it, you nip it in the bud immediately. If someone is calling a student, specifically a trans student, the wrong name or misgendering them, meaning calling them the incorrect pronouns, then you reprimand that behavior. And by role modeling great behavior in that way, by saying that, no, we're going to respect this student's identity and we're all going to accept her as she is or as he is or as they are, then I think that helps us all push forward. And I think the teacher is the number one contact to role model that kind of behavior.
What advice would you give a young trans person who might be bullied right now, and how should they handle the situation?
I think that, you know, find adults that who can advocate for you. Sometimes, you know, parents aren't able to do that, but maybe there's a counselor or a teacher who've always treated you with kindness. Maybe you start off right there and you develop a relationship with them somewhere that's a safe space for you. I think the number one thing would be to find people who are going to actually listen to you and affirm you in what you're saying, who are actually going to advocate for you within those spaces. That would be my number one thing. And also just to continue to craft those safe spaces for you through safe relationships, relationships that affirm you and make you feel as if you're heard.
Did you feel like you had that support network growing up?
Definitely. I think that's definitely something I'm also continuing to feel like I'm repeating a little bit. Like, I think I had that at home, I had that at school, and I had that around my friends. And so it's no coincidence that at, 18 years old, I was quite well adjusted as a young person because I had people around me who validated me and affirmed me. And I think that I keep on saying the word affirm because it's so important. I think a lot of trans people, especially young trans people, are told that who they are is wrong and that they're making it up. And I think that the more that we support these people and start listening to them, they have fuller lives and they have a better chance for greater possibilities in life.
Now, your boyfriend, Aaron, features prominently in your book as helping you come to terms with your identity. How did that relationship develop?
How did it develop? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think like any young people in an urban environment, I went to a bar and I met him, and we, you know, there was a spark and a connection, and we went on a few dates. And after a few dates, I wanted to tell him my story. And when I told him my story, that enabled us to go to a larger, I guess, more honest place together in our relationship. And we really got to know each other. And I think that the one thing, I think trans people's stories tend to be more dramatically told, but I think that we're all looking for the same thing. Anytime we're going into relationships with people, we want to be with people who will affirm us and love us for exactly who we are. And that's what I've been able to build with Aaron.
How long did you wait before you told him?
I detail that in the book, and I think I kind of want to keep that open so people can introduce that on the, you know, figure that out on their own. I don't want to give too much away within the context of the book.
Well, another pioneering woman in the trans community is Laverne Cox, an actress in the film Orange is the New Black. She was recently on The Katie Couric Show, and Katie asked her about transitioning. Laverne said that people put too much of an emphasis on transitioning and not enough emphasis on the daily struggles of being trans, and her response went viral. Let's take a listen to it.
The preoccupation with transition and with surgery objectifies trans people, and then we don't get to really deal with the real lived experiences. The reality of trans people's lives is that so often we're targets of violence. We experience discrimination disproportionately to the rest of the community. Our unemployment rate is twice the national average. If you're a trans person of color, it's four times the national average. The homicide rate in the LGBT community is highest amongst trans women. And if we focus on transition, we don't actually get to talk about those things. things. There was a young woman named Ilan Nettles who on August 17th was just walking down the street with some friends, you know, minding her own business, and she was catcalled by a couple of guys. And one of them, once they realized she was trans, she was beaten into a coma, and 5 days later she died. This is the reality of so many trans people's lives in this country, trans women of color, whose lives are in danger simply for being who they are. And we're looking for justice for Ilan's murder, and we're looking for justice for so many trans people across this country. And by focusing on bodies, we don't focus on the lived realities of that oppression and that discrimination.
You're so well spoken about.
Janet, what's your reaction as you listen to that? What should the public conversation about transgendered people be?
I think it should be the same conversation that we have when we're talking about women. I identify as my work as feminist work, and I believe that when we reduce people to their bodies, we objectify them and we strip them of their humanity. I think that that's what Laverne is talking to at the root of it. It's when we focus only on people's bodies and the surgeries that they have, we don't focus on their humanity, on their lives, on their loves, on the things that they want to do, on their passions and their pain, you know? And so for so long, trans people's stories have only been looked at as oddities, as body parts, not so much about what it's like to live in a culture in which there is so much gendered behavior where all of us are under, no matter if we're trans or not, we're all under this gender system that tells us if you're born this way, then you need to act this way. And so I think that trans people buck against that a lot, and therefore we get a lot of discussion around our lives and our identities. And so I love what Laverne said. The day after, I wrote a piece for Elle magazine about that issue. And I think that it was very amazing to see that it opened up a new conversation. And hopefully journalists who are listening to these stories are now asking better, more insightful questions.
Well, Janet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Janet Mock about her new book, Redefining Realness. It's a memoir about her experience as a young trans woman.
Usually at this time, you hear a Wisconsin Life piece here on Central Time. So today we'll have a few clips from the new Wisconsin Life TV show. It launches tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television.
Joe Ostrowski is here to give us a preview of the new show. He's a producer and reporter for Wisconsin Public Television. Joe, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Sure. Well, how is the Wisconsin Life TV show different from the radio episodes?
Well, the first difference, of course, is that it's on television, which gives us a little bit of luxury. You know, there are a lot of people who are doing incredible things around the state that are very visual. Lots of visual artists, lots of performers, lots of people who are carrying on family traditions or community traditions that are just remarkable visually. I can think, for example, of up in Shawano County, there are some folks who have been putting up barn quilts for the past few years that are just stunning, and to be able to show those to people, I think, is a real pleasure.
And what's the relationship between the radio series and the television show? Are we going to see a lot of the same stories told for television, or are these all unique stories?
A little bit of both. We've had some collaboration with some of the radio reporters and producers in going out in the field and gathering some of those stories. But we also have a lot of brand new, unique stories that are just now debuting for the first time. And some of those we'll be seeing new tonight, in fact, and over the next few weeks. A lot of the stories that we're trying to showcase involve personal stories. Also, people with their passions around the state. What is it that drives people in Wisconsin? What makes them unique? What makes them who they are?
Talk a little bit about how the TV episodes are structured. What can we expect?
Well, one thing you won't see is a host. There's a real goal here to let these people speak for themselves, to celebrate the character of the state. There is some narration on some of these individual stories, so during a half-an-hour show, you'll see a number of individual stories from different parts of the state, of people doing different types of things. We really want to have a good mix, a good diversity in terms of the types of stories we have, in terms of the backgrounds of the people we feature, and in terms of what parts of the state are represented there.
Well, let's listen to some examples. We've got some clips here. What are we about to hear first?
The first one I'd like to have is from Sandra Martinez from Door County. She's an artist. And in this clip, she's describing a moment when she was a younger artist, a couple decades ago, actually, when she had a conversation with a friend that sort of gave a new trajectory to her work and really her life.
I developed these personal drawings that are like primitive drawings. They're very stick figure-ish. They're very simple.
She kept working, kept drawing, until one conversation changed everything.
I had no idea that it was one of those monster turning points in your life where everything is different after that. And, you know, you look back now and it all seems so clear, but at the time it wasn't.
That was an episode of Wisconsin Life, the television show about a Wisconsin artist, and you can hear the radio version of this story Wednesday at 4:45 right here on Central Time. Let's roll right into another clip for the new show. What do you have for us next, Joe?
This is a poem by James P. Roberts. He lives in Madison. He rides a bicycle, and he is a big fan of libraries. In particular, he's a big fan of these little free libraries that are popping up all around the country. And if you've spent any time in Madison, you've no doubt seen dozens of them. This is a poem he wrote about what libraries have meant for him in his life.
Mother would take us to the East Side Library, where I would check out as many books as they would allow. And for those last few weeks before school, I would sit in the summer sun and read westerns, mysteries, sports, and science fiction, lapping up other lives like a thirsty dog. I often dreamed of one day living in a library where I could read all the books. But then I would miss Mother's good food.
That's from a story about Wisconsin's little free libraries. Tell us a little bit more about that story, Joe.
Well, what's remarkable about James is when those little free libraries first started popping up, and this is a story that one of my colleagues put together, he had a goal of biking to all of them in one day. And if you've seen how many of those have popped up, that's next to impossible. But he's really found kind of a sense of excitement and exploration in visiting all those different little free libraries and finding the little books that people have left in them. And really has developed a passion for those, something that a lot of us take for granted.
How are you finding people like James or all these stories that you're featuring here on Wisconsin Life?
Well, I think we found the easiest way to find people, and easy is probably the wrong word, but one of the most effective ways to find people is to just get in the car, drive to a neighborhood, drive to a town, and knock on doors. Go visit a library, go visit a church, go visit a community center, and say, listen, is there anybody who's doing something interesting here in town or who has an interesting story? And 9 times out of 10, people can name someone. The one challenge is so often people assume that, you know, these people that they spend their lives with that are in their neighborhoods, that are in their communities, again, they take them for granted. They assume, well, who would be interested in that story? And we are. We're interested in those stories. And I think people, when they see the chance to suggest that one of their neighbors, one of their friends, one of their coworkers is doing something that's deserving of attention, they jump at the chance. And they've been very helpful.
I'm reminded of Steve Hartman's stories with CBS News, and we see his features on 60 Minutes and CBS Sunday Morning. He's been remaking the Charles Carrelt On the Road series. But back in the 90s, he did a series called Every Life Has a Story, and he literally threw a dart on a map, flew to that town, found a phone book, opened it up to a random page, put his finger on a random name, and called that person and got their story. And that's what I'm kind of hearing you say with a little bit of a Wisconsin twist.
That's true. And, you know, for a lot of us who are younger TV reporters, and it's kind of a geeky thing to do, but every now and then after work, you know, we'd sit around and we'd look up Steve Hartman stories online and watch them and talk about them. And certainly enjoyed him. What the kind of thing he did, recognizing, again, that everybody does have a story, is the kind of thing that really inspires a lot of us, and a lot of us are trying to do in different ways. And being able to work on this project is definitely a chance to do that.
Yeah, he does a great job. Well, we do have one more clip. Joe, why don't you set this one up for us?
Right. This is Wayne Valier from Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin. He is one of just a few Ojibwe birch bark canoe makers that are still around in the Midwest. And he does a lot of work with youth, showing them the traditions that go into making these canoes. And here he talks about the connection between his artistry and the natural world.
You don't go on your terms, on your time. You go on nature's time. And for an example, the birch, it only peels in mid-June to maybe early July. So there's a short window of opportunity to actually harvest the bark. The roots are there, gotten usually later in the fall when the sap runs into the tree. We usually harvest our cedar when the swamp is frozen, because we go into the cedar swamp, there's no mosquitoes. It's easy to travel into the swamps to get the cedar for all the woodworking in the canoe.
That's from a story about the connection between nature and canoe making. Joe, what more would you like us to know about that story?
Well, what's really remarkable is that Wayne has made a point, and this is something that was inspired by his grandmother, has made a point of passing on native culture as best as he can and in as many different ways as he can. So while he shows young kids in elementary school, junior high school, and high school how these canoes are made, he takes a step back and talks about culture, talks about current issues too, issues of health and the health of the environment. So he's really taken kind of a holistic approach to the making of a canoe.
Joe, I've come to learn that you're not from Wisconsin.
That's
you're
true.
You're actually from Illinois. What's your impression of life in the Badger State so far as a result of this job?
It's incredibly diverse. You know, that's what I've learned, is that, from town to town, county to county, block to block, this is a diverse state, and there are a lot of people who make an effort to live here for one reason or another, and in different communities, and that each community has little gems of people who are doing really phenomenal, creative, exciting things that they're really passionate about. And it seems like there's something about Wisconsin that attracts people who are really excited about doing something and want a good place to do it.
Well, thank you so much, Joe, for being with us.
Thank you, Cynthia.
That's Joe Ostrowski, a producer and reporter for Wisconsin Public Television.